and welcome to another episode of But Why, the podcast that's all about digging into big questions and tricky topics by honest conversation. This week, we're going to be looking at conflict. And my guest is a coach, a facilitator, a dispute resolution professional with 15 years experience as an employment and commercial mediator. She's a visiting lecturer on mediation at the University of Westminster, a business faculty member of the School of Life, and a mother of two. Without further ado, let me introduce to you Tracy Scott. Tracy Scott's not even here. Tracy Fox. Let's try again. Without further ado, I need this coffee to get in my system soon. Without further ado, let me introduce to you Tracy Fox. What a CV.
I know. It's just a nightmare, Clemmy. To be honest, when people say, what do you do? I say, oh, just things around conflict. Because it's just too long-winded, you know.
I think it's too long-winded.
I wish I was like a nurse, you know, or a teacher. Oh. And then, you know, everybody knows exactly what it is that you do. But although everything I do is related to conflict, it's all little kind of facets around it.
I think there are so few people who have kind of a very singular job anymore.
True.
But yeah, that's absolutely my worst ever question. What do you do for a job? I'm like, oh, I've got an Instagram account, but I don't ever know how to phrase that. And it's awful because if you don't own your own introduction, how are you ever meant to anyone else? Yeah. But thanks to you, I actually went on LinkedIn for the first time yesterday for a while. It's a whole different world. I quite enjoyed it. But you just see some faces like, wow.
Yeah.
People you just from different parts of your career it's basically a whole different kind of social media stalking, but just professional.
To be honest, I mostly use LinkedIn, although I don't really use it as such. It's the kind of, you know, the right thing to do, putting on your kind of best face in the professional space. But even that, it's more about, you know, I'm doing this now and I'm doing that now. Mm. It's interesting, but it's great to look for jobs, really, you know, and find, you know, networking connections and opportunities. So,
yeah, I mean, actually, I did think to myself, if you were smart with this and poured some energy into it, I'm sure it would really pay dividends, but it's the sort of thing I think and then forget that that's what I've decided I should do. But there are people doing it really well, definitely, aren't there?
Yes, yeah, definitely. And I know people who've been headhunted into fantastic jobs just because of who they are on LinkedIn. It can work very, very well for people, although I don't use it anywhere near as much as I should.
No, and for the record, this sounds like a real big plug for LinkedIn. It's just something that it's not, but then maybe I could talk to them about it. But yeah, it's quite nice, I guess, as well. Yeah, this is just me using you as a therapy session, but because I have a version of me that's on Instagram, I was in advertising for 15 years before I did Instagram. So it's quite nice within LinkedIn, I'm still through that lens, which I quite likes for some reason. Anyway, enough of that. I always start with three not very important but quite fun questions. How are you really? What star sign are you, and what's your favorite biscuit?
They're nice, they're great questions. How am I really? Right now, today, I'm actually quite good. And that's because it was my birthday on Tuesday. So I'm grateful, you know, grateful to be alive for another year. I'm 47 now. I forget. I kind of stopped counting many years ago. Mm-hmm. I stopped counting and I have to remind myself. And then when I think about how old I am, I think, wow, you know, I am, you know, getting on in years, but very grateful for that, grateful for my health and, you know, my opportunities to be able to, you know, put a roof over my head and stuff like that. So, yeah, I'm feeling very grateful. So my star sign, of course, is Libra.
Yeah, I knew that.
Just
thinking, great, I already know the answer. If I hadn't asked you the question, I would have been like, yes, I know what star sign she is.
Yeah, and biscuits, it's funny, I was talking to one of the mums at netball yesterday, not me playing, I took my daughter to netball, and we were just talking about the way in which, you know, as you get older, your body changes. It doesn't respond in the same way that it does to things. And she was saying that the three things that are, you know, that really are against her are the three B's. It's bread, booze and biscuits. So we were talking about biscuits. She even liked rich tea, which I thought, oh my God, who actually likes rich tea biscuits?
No.
And I was not saying, yet. No, exactly. My favourite biscuits are either chocolate hobnobs or really my number one are the kind of M&S extremely chocolatey rounds. So I don't eat them very often, but it's yeah, that wonderful ratio of more chocolate to biscuit, I think.
Yeah. That works for me. I mean, really, you can't have those in the house on a regular basis. It's an absolute no-go because they are so decadent but delicious. But it's so true about your body not responding in the same way. Yeah, and it's difficult. I mean, I have a more comfortable relationship with my body than I've ever had. But with that, I guess I know very honestly in myself that, yeah, I will let myself eat whatever I want to eat, you know. But yeah, my body just really, particularly sugar, my body really, really doesn't like it. And it's so, and it's one of those things I find that I quite quickly introduce more and more and more into my diet. And then by the end of a week, just feel quite ropey.
Yeah. Or I find that if I eat a lot of sugar now, I just want to fall asleep. So it's like that kind of sugar high. Can't even handle it anymore, you know. So, you know, I have to put away the box of wine gums and things. Yeah, no, not the packet of wine gums, but the box of wine gums that I might like to indulge in and fall into a sugar coma. So, I do have to stay clear of sugar as well nowadays.
But maybe as you're talking, I'm thinking maybe this is how you end up at a rich tea, because as your tolerance goes down, and you're like, well, this is to be able to have a biscuit
I can't stand them. Sorry, rich tea.
Wow, that's extreme. I mean, yeah, they're just very average, aren't they? Anyway, none of this is what I'm here to talk to you about. I'm here to talk to you about conflict, which I've really enjoyed kind of sitting and thinking about this and reading through some stuff that you sent me. When we say conflict, is there a very succinct or easy way to understand what conflict is?
Yeah, so I mean, there have been lots of there are lots of definitions of conflict which can be conflictual, but for me and what I teach, I say that conflict is it can be an actual or perceived, it can be a disagreement, a difference, or a dispute, but essentially something that leads to disharmony. So whether there is kind of tension or disharmony, for me that means that there is a conflict, and it doesn't have to be full blown out war or litigation. It can be the little niggle that you feel because what you want or expect is different to what the other person wants or expects. Or likewise, there can be inner conflict where that's more a kind of physical or psychological feeling. But again, it goes back to disharmony. There is an element of disharmony and tension. Then there is potential conflict which can be attended to and addressed or not.
And is conflict inherently negative, is what I'm wondering, or not?
Well, I think that the occurrence of it and the process, when it's happening in the here and now, it can often feel negative. It throws you off course. It throws you off balance. You become alert to it. You might feel uncomfortable. And that is when it's taking place. But the reality is, if you are able to be brave enough, or you have the competence and the confidence to step into that space and engage with it, it can often lead to really positive outcomes. So it's the kind of the trigger can be can feel negative. That's why you notice it, right? You notice it, but don't leave it hanging. If you leave it hanging, it can stay that way, if not escalate even further into something destructive. But as I said, if you can step into that space, engage with it, then it can lead to really brilliant outcomes.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering. As I was doing the research for this, I was trying to work out if I'm, because you have some people who it seems seek out conflict and then you have some people who are totally conflict averse, don't you? And neither of those places are particularly easy to sit with. But I through the work that I do, I'm a big advocate for honest conversations and the power of that. And I feel that that sits within this space of conflict. I think the dangerous part or the problematic part of conflict is when that it becomes super emotionally loaded or it feels unsafe, whereas actually you can have disagreements with people done in a grown-up way that is, yeah, really valuable.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, Clemmie, because you speak about honest conversations and, you know, when I read about you, I see the things that you do and say you are, you come across as very, very honest and, you know, quite real and you know, and raw. But in my world and the world that I step into when I work in businesses in the UK, all over the world, people are not having honest conversations. Really? People are living in fear often, or mm-hmm. they are driven by their past experiences where they have tried to speak out and they have been punished or reprimanded or humiliated or whatever it might be. So people just don't have the honest conversations. Maybe fear for upsetting the other person and then being upset, or just fear, you know, thinking that it's not going to go away. But if you don't find a way and a mechanism to communicate what's happening for you, then that is definitely when conflict kind of builds up and escalates. It doesn't go away. So yes, I guess more people need to live like you, really finding that way to have the honest conversation, because it really doesn't happen often enough.
And I'm sitting here thinking it's quite interesting. So as I mentioned in reference to LinkedIn, but I've come from a much more corporate background, although it's advertising, so it's obviously creative industries. To be honest, when it's actually quite a complicated world, because it's got a facade of being quite relaxed and creative, but there's big corporate structures at play. And I think part of what's led me to the work that I do now is exactly that, not having honest conversations, particularly around pay and hierarchy. And, you know, this is a bit of an aside, but I definitely grew up very conditioned to be the good girl and not rock the boat. And so it can feel unsafe, can't it, to say, hold up, I disagree. And so, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what I spend a lot of my time doing, teaching the skills for having difficult conversations, teaching skills of self-awareness in what do you do when what you want is different to what the other person wants, and how can you communicate that in a way that feels authentic and right for you. And yes, you might get it wrong, you know, at first, but it's about knowing that we do have options regardless of how we were raised and our early experiences of how we should, you know, deal with challenges. I mean, like I was my family are from Jamaica, and they came over in the 1970s, part of the Windrush generation, and you know, my parents are wonderful, but you know, I was raised under the premise of children should be seen and not heard, right? So I didn't have a voice, really. I was happy and had a happy childhood, but when it came to disagreement, you know, no, it wasn't about disagreement. You kind of follow line, you know, you follow suit. And I think that it was that led me to being really interested in finding out, well, how do I have a voice? How do I express myself? Mm. And how can I help others to be in this space? So, yeah, yeah.
It's so interesting as you're talking, because I know I've watched it myself, even in some very small interactions this week, like a family conversation about where we'd go for a group dinner, and the locations were not really very good for us because of where we live. And I immediately go into that. Again, I don't know if it is conflict. It is, because you've got different things having to, you know, some negotiation needs to go on. And I always start with, oh, sorry to be difficult, or I could be wrong, but, and, you know, that is your, that's such, and I don't know if it's female, but that would be my default way. And I don't know if that's, yeah, it doesn't really, you kind of, feeling myself that I'm selling myself short when I do that, but it's not wanting to bulldoze anyone, but also try and get your point across.
But the family dynamics lead a whole, you know, they're a whole different ballgame, aren't they?
Yeah.
Because it's a little system, and we all have parts and roles that we play, right? It's like the book, is it Eric Byrne, The Games That People Play, Transaction Analysis, where we're in transactions when we're either a parent, an adult, or a child, and there are people who can draw us into, you know, ideally we have adult-to-adult conversations. You know, I'm an adult speaking to an adult, but you can be in a dynamic either with family members or with strangers or people, and they draw you into behaving like a child, either kind of a stubborn child or a kind of spoiled child, or they can draw you into being, you know, a parent, either a kind of a condescending parent or a nurturing parent. And within the family unit itself, we will fall into patterns of behavior that are acceptable or not. So it's great to hear that actually you are you're being quite assertive, aren't you? You're saying, you know, sorry to be a pain, sorry to be a difficult, sorry to be a nuisance, but so at least you are being clear and you're having that honest conversation, because the easy thing for you to do is just to fall into the childhood patterns and just agree regardless of the inconvenience. So, you know, we all find our way, but the most important thing is to express what's important to us, I think, instead of going away and feeling frustrated or going to the dinner and on the way to the dinner just complaining the whole time, oh, why am I doing this? And I shouldn't be going here. Why didn't I say anything? And yeah,
you're so right. And again, it makes me think back to like being in a workplace. So often, this is an important point that you made about perceived conflict, and the thought that comes to my mind is people were putting in meetings at a point after when I needed to go and leave to pick up kids, and I, you know, increasingly I was feeling bad about that and getting resentful and angry, and then I realized that the person putting these meetings in was just someone quite junior, and they, you know, bath time and bedtime was just not on their radar. And so what I had escalated into this thing was actually just them not knowing, and all I needed to do was have the courage to say to them, actually, do you mind if we just did this at this time? Yeah. And they're like, oh yeah, absolutely. And and thus it was solved. Yeah. But it feels like there's so many versions of that, of these perceived things that blow up.
And we play a part in that, don't we? We kind of enable things, and if we don't tell somebody, then, you know, how on earth can they know? And sometimes we tell them and they don't care. That's one thing. But at the very least, by saying, actually, you know, that really doesn't work for me, can we swap it to this time instead? Can we do this or do that? So, yeah, we have to. Again, it goes back to having the courage, often, having the courage to speak out. And even the word courage, this sounds really corny, but I do like it. The word courage or courageous conversations, the Latin, I don't speak Latin, but I know that the Latin root of the word courage, cor, means heart. So in order to be courageous, which is being brave and being bold, you have to tap into your heart and do what your heart is telling you to do. So it's a really big step to do that, but it requires courage to speak out sometimes and to express yourself. But if you do, you're likely to feel that in your heart. You know, it's a really emotional thing that you're stepping into.
I love that. I'm trying to think that, yeah, because it's bravery and courage, because that's the difference between courage and just doing things kind of without engaging your mind, I guess. So that is, it's those mini leaps of faith, isn't
that's it? That's right. Yeah. I like that. Mini leaps of faith, which are different for everyone. So for somebody, it could be, what's courageous for one person can be very different to another. Saying no for some people is very, very easy. You know, it just rolls off the tongue and they're happy with the consequences. For others, even daring to, you know, to kind of express some kind of disagreement is a huge deal for them. So it's often about helping people to be courageous in the moment to deal with the conflict.
Yeah, and I think it's reassuring for people to know that internal dialogue goes on, because when you do see people who feel like they're really good at speaking their mind, you don't know actually what pep talk they've given themselves to do that. And we can wrongly assume that this comes easy to everyone, and I would guess that isn't the case.
Yeah, that's a really good point, you know, Clemmie, because we have sometimes when we say this at the School of Life, we have no idea what's going on inside our own heads, what's say somebody else's. And there is always an internal dialogue, if not a few internal dialogues happening inside our heads, which are different to what we're saying. And you're right, when we hear somebody speaking out or speaking boldly or whatever it is that they're doing, we have no idea of how they've been able to connect the dots to be at that point. How have they been able to speak in an articulate way or a confident way? It could be because they were reared in a household where they were always encouraged to speak out. They were always encouraged to counter, you know, what do you think? You know, do you agree? Do you disagree? You know, tell me what you think. Therefore, it's natural for them. Or it could be something that they have to practice intensively. Mm-hmm. They've been up all night stressing about it, worrying about it all weekend, and then it comes out. So yes, we have to, you know, be, you know, forgiving of ourselves. But no, it can take work and it takes practice.
Yeah. Which I guess is why you have the role that you do, because it isn't necessarily inherent for everyone. So I know there is, because I've read some of your work, but there are different conflict styles, am I right?
That's right, yeah. I mean, there are lots of different models and frameworks for how we engage in conflict and what we might do in the moment where what we want is different to what somebody else wants. But one of the models that I really like is by it's by two American professors, Thomas and Kilman, back in the, I think they were Harvard professors back in the 1970s. But the model's really brilliant because it essentially says that when you find yourself in a situation where what you want is different to what the other person wants, there are two primary drivers that will affect how you behave. The first is, how important is the task to you, or the kind of outcome? And if the kind of outcome or the goal or the task is important, then you're likely to be very assertive because you're really fixed on achieving that task or goal or getting something. And then the second element that Thomas and Kilman talk about is, how important is the relationship with the other person? And if you really value the relationship, then you will be very kind of supportive, and you'll be you know, really thinking about what can I do to build on this relationship, and you'll be very you know, supportive towards that person. But actually, if the relationship is not important, then you won't necessarily be very cooperative towards that person. And they kind of draw that up on a matrix on an XY axis, and you can fall into one of five different conflict styles. Your behavior can be categorized as one of five different conflict styles. And what they say is that of the five, there is going to be at least one, if not two, perhaps, that you're very comfortable in using. You use every day. You don't think about it. It's like picking up a pen and just writing your name. You know, you don't give it any thought. But they like to remind you that there are other ways. There are at least three other ways, other options that may feel very uncomfortable for you. It's like picking up a pen and writing with your non-preferred hand. If you're not left-handed, if you try and write your name with your left hand, it's very awkward and clunky and very deliberate, but you can probably write your name with your left hand if you tried. Likewise, if you want to use a different style in the moment, you can, but it takes practice. So I kind of teach that model, talk about the different styles, and help people to think about, what do you do in the moment? What is the style that feels very comfortable, and is that working for you? Because sometimes the style that you use, it's absolutely fine. You know, it gets you through your day-to-day interactions. But then there'll be other times where you think, right, well, I'm always accommodating other people. That's my style. That's one of the five. I'm an accommodator. I'm completely focused on the other person. The relationship is really important. My own needs are very, very low. You know, it's about, what do you want? How can I help you? And, you know, for some people in their careers or in the roles that they have, that's an essential way of survival, really. If you're new to an organization, new to a business, maybe even if you're new in a relationship, or particularly when people are younger as well, they may find the need to be more accommodating, valuing what the other person wants over themselves. But there are dangers to all of these styles, because if you overuse it, if you're always focused on the other person, well, you don't get anything done for yourself. You kind of say, yes, 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 you overpromise, and under-deliver because you're always wanting to please. And it can lead to a lot of resentment and frustration. Mm. And probably people won't respect you very much because I know you're a bit of a pushover. So each of these styles, you know, have its real value, and they're valid and legitimate and necessary. But there's a danger of overusing the styles.
Well, it's quite complex to those kind of, I guess it's emotional literacy, isn't it, about when to dial in? Because when you're talking about being accommodating, my default is like a bit of a, oh no, that's a risky game to play because it can spiral. But actually, then it's something I talk to my children about, where actually you do have to understand hierarchies. You know, I often say to him, I'm really sorry, your children, you don't get to make the call here. And I think it's important in the workplace. I think some of that has been lost, actually. You know, I definitely had to learn my skills, learn my craft, fall in line. And yeah. I think there's a bit of an expectation of more flat hierarchies now. But I really think that's actually not ideal, because experience and wisdom do need to count for something.
Yeah. And I mean, I mentioned one of the styles. I spoke about the accommodating style, which is high on the relationship, low on assertiveness and task, which is valid. But when you spoke about the approach that you will have with your children sometimes, saying, you know, sorry, I'm the adult, this is what I say, this is what's going to happen, that's a very different style. That's the top left, because it's Thomas and Kilman labeled that as compete. So you're completely focused on your own goal, what you want, your own task, with no with very little concern for the relationship and how it's going to affect the other person. You accept they're going to be unhappy, so be it. And you're right, you know, that's classic, you know, a classic compete style. And if we think about behaviours, you know, I don't like to be political, but I think we can all agree that someone like Donald Trump is high on the compete. It's what he wants, very little regard for how other people think. And of course, he has a lot of supporters that think like him. So each of these are valid. But if you're always like that with everyone in every interaction, then, you know, people are going to get to dislike you pretty quickly, because, you know, it's my way or the highway. So it's being strategic and deciding, when does this situation need me to use a different style that perhaps I'm not comfortable with, you know, it will help me fulfill my needs.
Because it's interesting, on that XY axis you're talking about, you're saying that when you've got a relationship with someone, then you're more likely to be more accommodating. But I'm actually wondering also then whether that sometimes swings almost back on itself. Because I was talking to my friends about sometimes how you treat your partner with things like this compared to how you would if they're a colleague. And you have to check yourself. Like, actually, do you know what I'm saying? Sometimes you swing so much the other way that you aren't as accommodating as you could be.
Yeah. It's interesting. So with the model, five different styles, which are kind of accommodate, avoid, compete, compromise, and collaborate, that what is that the aim is to be I was going to say ambidextrous, but it's not ambidextrous. It's that style flexibility.
Yeah.
You want to be able to dip into each of the styles dependent on what the situation needs. And one conversation, you can actually move around that grid. You could start off being accommodated. There might be something that you compete on. No, this is what we're doing. All right, then you compromise, or you say, well, actually, I'm going to avoid that part of the conversation, and let's work on this together. So the idea is to move around the grid. But when it comes to people that we're close to, that's interesting in itself. I remember there was an article, I think it was in something like the New York Times or something, not that I read that very regularly, it just came up, and it was saying how it spoke about listening, which is a huge my number one go-to skill set for managing conflict. But in this article it was saying that the research had proven that we listen less to people that we are close to, and that's because we believe we know what they're going to say, therefore we don't need to bother listening to them. We know what it's going to lead to, and so we are more likely to shut them down and just focus on our own agenda. So I think you're right, Clemmie, when you say that you know, the style that we might use when we're, you know, being caring and, you know, empathetic and interested in someone can be very different with how we are with those who are closest to us.
And that, I think you're right, that listening is the absolute key thing. I actually wrote about it in my book, that we're really losing, I believe, a lot of our listening skills, purely partly because of social media. There's so much projection out and not so much quiet consumption in, I don't think. But I know that you've got, there's different kinds of listening, aren't there? Could you say a bit about that?
So this is one of my favorite things, actually. So there are a number of different listening models. One of the one I like comes from the book. I'm doing all these, they're not plugs, but I don't
no,
like
I love
to,
it. I'm impressed. I want to be
I don't
this
like
person.
To kind of attribute. I don't like to pretend it's my own. I wish it was my own. But in Stephen Covey's book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, he speaks about the levels of listening. Mm-hmm. And I think I've kind of simplified it by saying there are essentially 5 levels of listening. And level 1 listening is not really listening at all. You're just waiting for your turn to speak. So it means that you're in a conversation with somebody and they're talking to you, but actually not really paying attention to what they're saying, because you're thinking about what you want to say next or what's going on for you. So it might sound something like, you know, it's the end of the day, you turn the computer off, you go and, you know, sit in, you know, in front of the TV with a friend or a spouse or whatever, and you say, oh my gosh, I had a really, really, really stressful day today. And they turn and say, can you pass me the remote control, for instance? Which happens, right? It happens, and we all do it. Level 1 listening, we're not paying attention. We're thinking, what's happening? Or what's for dinner? You know, what's happening for me rather than what's happening for you? Level 2 listening is relating the information to yourself. So you're in the living room. You say, oh my gosh, I had a really stressful day today. They turn around and say, you had a stressful day. Well, let me tell you about me. Oh my gosh, I couldn't believe it. From the moment I woke up, it was constant Zooms and Teams. It was just a nightmare. And they spend the next, you know, 10 minutes talking about themselves. And again, it's, you know, we all do this. You know, I do this. We're all guilty of it. And I think relating, when we speak to people, people genuinely want to show an interest. That's why they relate it to themselves. But often it means they're taking the focus away from you onto themselves. Level 3 listening is giving advice. And, you know, someone says, oh, I had a really, really stressful day. And then, you know, your partner says, oh, well, you know, what you need to do is, you know, just don't put up with it anymore, or just quit and then it'll be fine. Now, can you get me the remote control, for instance? And I don't know about you, but I often find people don't want advice, right? That's the last thing they want. People don't ask for it. They don't want it. But often we feel the need to give advice because it shuts things down, doesn't it? Most of us are paid problem solvers. That's what we do. How do we solve this problem? So you solve the problem and you move on to the next thing. Level 4 listening is you do listen, but not for very long. And then, you know, you quickly revert to one of the other levels. You can maybe give them a bit of attention and then, you know, tell them what's going on for you, relate it to yourself or give advice. And level 5 listening is the space that we encourage you to practice, because if you're in that space, that will help you in conflict. Level 5 listening is active listening, which is where your role is to help the speaker think as fully and broadly as possible about what's going on for them, without relating it to yourself, without telling them what to do, without shutting them down, but really being in that space to help them think, really, and expand their thoughts. Now, it can sound really strange and artificial, because often we do want to shut people down and we're not really interested, right? But this is what transforms dialogue. Mm. This is what transforms relationships. Mm-hmm. In fact, I've got there are 2 colleagues that I work with at CEDA, and they were both hostage negotiators. In fact, one of them, they used to train hostage negotiators for I don't know if it was Scotland Yard or the Met or whatever. And they, I remember what there was one year where one of them went out to do some training with the FBI in Virginia. It makes me think of the kind of Silence of the Lambs type thing. And he came back and he said, oh, what did you do? Well, you know, what did you do out there? And, you know, he said it was pretty much, you know, a week and a half of active listening.
Wow.
That's all we were doing, spending the time listening. And it really drummed home that if the number one skill that is used in the most conflictual of situations that will stop somebody hurting themselves or others, jumping off a building, doing whatever it is, and your my role is to listen and encourage, you know, to understand what they have to say, then I thought surely we need to practice that, you know, more in our day-to-day lives. So listening is well, as it is for you, you know, massive skill.
Hello, a quick break to tell you about a brand founded on what I think is a brilliant idea. It's called Whirly, and it's a children's toy box subscription service. For a fixed monthly cost, you get access to what is basically a humongous toy box of toys. I'm talking really great brands too. There's Melissa and Doug, Plan, Wobbleboard, Strider Bikes, Oliver Jeffers Books, to name but a few. You pick your selection of toys, Whirly delivers them, and then your kids play with them to their heart's content. And trust me, they've made a selection of stuff which is really robust and can't be broken, even by the most feisty kids. Then when they're done with them, you can send them back and Whirly will exchange them for another selection of things, and so on and so on. So you've got a constantly changing selection of toys in your house. How clever is that? It's really easy. It gives you way more for your money. It reduces the dreaded living room clutter. And of course, it's environmentally friendly too. And it feels particularly pertinent at this time of year. According to research conducted by Whirly, 23% of Christmas toys are neglected within 1 month, which translates to a whopping 32 million toys in the UK fated for landfills. And before they end up in landfills, they're actually cluttering our homes. In my house, some things are even dismissed as early as Boxing Day. So, given all that, Whirly makes a really, really smart solution. It's a chance for kids to play with a huge range of toys and for us not to have to worry about which bits do and don't capture their imagination, because if they don't like them, they can just go back. If all that sounds good to you, then how about giving Whirly a go? I've actually got a code for you, which is Clemmy30, which will give you 30% off a Whirly subscription or on Whirly gift cards if you wanted to buy some for someone else. And you'll also find me chatting to Whirly founder Nigel Fan on IGTV. We chat about how he came up with the business idea, how it came to market, and also a general, more sustainable approach to toys at Christmas, but also toys in general. So go check that out.
I'm thinking as you're talking, but listening actively, that but one of my best I've had, because I panic. As an interviewer, you do have to kind of both be really focused, but also thinking, where am I going with this? Because otherwise you sit there and you're like, I'm really drawn into what you're saying, and now it's going
to
go sun.
I don't know what to say. Yeah.
But I had a very, an amazing therapist for a while, and she used to always just, her one piece of language that stayed with me was say more. So you'd talk and then you'd think you'd
That's
stop
nice.
And she'd go, say more. And then and then you go again. And I use that so often because it's so unloaded. And often that follow-up bit that people do is the bit. And often, yeah, people just want to unpick their own thoughts, don't they?
Yes. I really like that. I did a course recently. It was based on the work of Nancy Klein and her book Time to Think.
Mm-hmm.
And it talks about creating spaces for people to think. I believe that Nancy was a Quaker, and her philosophy was the quality of our decisions is based on the quality of our thinking. So creating spaces for people to think in meetings, and as I understand, I don't know anything about the Quaker practice, but as I understand, at the beginning of a Quaker meeting, what would often happen is if a question is asked, and I think, is it the Finnish culture, they're similar, but you would ask a question and then you would literally leave that space for people to think. And people really want to think deeply and you know, comprehensively about the question, whereas for most of us, we think that it's essential to respond quickly, immediately, with something, you know, superficial and surface level. But as you said, Clemmy, if you give someone the space and you say, yeah, and what else do you think and feel, what more, you unpeel the onion, don't you, and you get to layers. And if you have the patience to hold it and you do that with ease, the discovery is just phenomenal. You reveal things that you actually didn't even realize that you thought or felt. So yes, so we're not saying to provide a therapy session for every conversation that you
because that
have.
Would be exhausting.
It would be exhausting, but to know that when you are in a conflictual situation, when there is tension and stress, number one, you probably don't listen very well anyway. Mm. Number two, when you're talking, you're not learning. But when you're listening, you're learning. Mm. So you need to find out what's happening for you. What don't I know about you in this situation? You're shouting at me, you're really angry, or you're frustrated. What don't I know? And what can I learn to help me engage with you more effectively?
It's so true. Yeah. And I mean, a couple of things, as you say, that quick reaction again, which is absolutely central to internet culture, jumping on, yeah. And no one is anyone stopping and thinking here. And there's a Buddhist expression which is even cloudy water will clear once it's left to settle. You know, so often we just need to come back, pause, and actually within conflict, it's quite interesting because I think there's something I read which is any conflict you have, leave it 24 hours, but say something within 48, I think is the rule that I heard. So I think there is that old thing that all our grandparents said, which is sleep on it, is so true because things can be hot-headed, but also leaving things to fester is equally dangerous. So yeah, sitting with something, but then coming back to it, because it's not fair to also to go to someone, oh, you know, 3 weeks ago you did this, and come in with pulling them up on it. I mean, you can, but you know what I mean? It's more than likely with that time, you've brought all these layers onto it and you're no longer conflicted about the thing you were conflicted about.
Yeah, well, you're lucky if it's 3 weeks. I mean, I've worked a lot in organisations and I've helped them with kind of, you know, the annual appraisal and working with managers on how to conduct that. And I've always said, when you are meeting with people to talk about their performance, nothing should be new, right? If something happens in the moment, deal with it, because otherwise it's like 6 months later, you did this and you did that. That's no use to anyone, right? No use to anyone. So I generally think that that people are we are becoming more familiar with trying to engage and express ourselves about challenges that we feel, and sometimes we get it wrong. You know, people will be, you know, people might say, well, I'm just being honest, you know, or I'm being upfront. And you know, you want to be honest with sensitivity as well and empathy, but I think, yeah, you know, I think that we are moving more towards trying to be more expressive about the challenges that we face. But I do think the whole idea of listening is a piece that is missing, because most of us were never taught how to listen, right? We just don't, we weren't taught how to do it. And there was some research done, I think it was at the University of Minnesota in the States, and they tested children at the age of 6 and at the age of 14 on how well they listened. And I think the experiment was something along the lines of, you had a teacher in the class reading out a story or a passage or something to the 6-year-old, and then they would orchestrate it. So somebody else came in and interrupted the class, then that person left, and then the teacher said, oh, what was I talking about, you know? And then and when it came to 6-year-olds, I think their average recall was about 90% of what the teacher said, you know, that, you know, she had them or he had them, you know, really focused. But when they conducted that same experiment with like 14-year-olds, that the recall went down to like 28%.
Wow.
Now, that was 14-year-olds. I'm now 47, so I'm way off the chart. So my recall is probably about zero. So luckily, I have learnt to listen. And I've taught my husband and my daughters how to listen. So now they do say, all right, level one listening, honey. All right, level one. And I'm like, oh, sorry, because I do it a lot. But it helps when you know, right? When you know, then you can do. But if you don't know, then you're just going to be focused on, you know, what's important to you rather than giving the other person the space.
Yeah, and I can't help but think that if you're not listening properly, you could end up trying to solve the problem that isn't the problem. And I definitely know that with children, you know, I always think when you're putting them to bed, and part of it is a distraction technique, but suddenly it all comes out. And, you know, the thing that you thought that they were talking to you about isn't it at all. That's how you get to the good stuff. And that is the same with all of our relationships. And unfortunately, again, I'll keep going back to this, but we've got with our phones, we've got this easy distraction so often.
It shuts everything else down, doesn't it? I mean, it's wonderful, it's incredible, but it shuts everything down. And, you know, there's a the ancient Chinese script for the word listen is made up of five different components. And it says, so if you look at the word listen, I think it translates as the word ting. And it says, when you are listening, in order to listen, you have to listen with your ears. Yes, of course. But you also listen with your eyes as if you had 10 eyes. So pay attention to what the person is saying. Your eyes are wide and you're really focused looking at that person. It says that you need to listen as if that person that you're talking to is the only person on earth, so you're completely present and engaged. The symbol for heart is in that ting script, because it says you listen with your heart. What are you feeling? What are you sensing and picking up on when you are listening to the individual? And then the other kind of component of the word, of the symbol for listen, ting, is king or queen. So listen as if that person were a king or queen. You give them complete respect. And that's ancient. It's saying, you know, this is what you have to do when you're paying attention to somebody. And we don't do any of that, really. You know, we just lost so much of it. And then we think, well, what's it been replaced by? And is it working for us, right? Or are there times where we think, well, we do need to switch to something else, but most people just don't know what to do anymore. It's so habitual. But yeah, just having human to human conversations, paying attention and noticing what someone is experiencing, whether it's happiness or sadness or conflict, is, yeah, it's the first step, recognizing what's in front of you.
And it's really the greatest gift we can give another person. I mean, this feels a thing away from conflict, but is our undivided attention, isn't it? Often when kids are doing all those why questions, it's because really they just want your attention. They want you just you 100% on them. And it is true. We are those moments that were sacred for this exact kind of interaction, meal times, long journeys, even in queues for places, you know, where you might be, they're all being eroded. And again, of course, I'm not hating on technology, but I think we have to be really aware of the bigger picture of what that is. If we're not having conversations, if we're not having time to think, then we're not really working out how we want to go about in the world. And maybe then it's no surprise that you do see these conflicts escalate in digital spaces for all these reasons, because there is no listening and there is no breathing space. It just goes like wildfire, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It's interesting because but my daughters are upstairs, so I hope they're not listening. But it makes me think about how we fall into patterns of behaviour. And when I was in my 20s, I did smoke a little bit. I won't say it too loudly in case they listen.
I was a committed smoker in my 20s.
But then when I got to the age of 30, just before I had my daughter, I thought, actually, when I started, I never intended to be a smoker for 10 years. You know, it was just something I would start. And when I look back, I think that wasn't my intention. So now we have these phones and we have, you know, technology and devices, which is wonderful. But my intention is never to allow this to be a blocker
to the real life
or a contributor to real life or to conflict. So it's about being mindful. What's actually happening in the moment and how am I contributing to it? But we fall into patterns, don't we, which are not helpful. So it goes back to self-awareness. You know, what are we doing and what could we be doing differently? Let's just, you know, take a moment to think about our intention and how we want to live, and how we want to have conversations so I think a lot of it is taking a moment to think about how we contribute to a situation and knowing that we've got a choice to do something differently.
And actually, again, going back to kind of workplaces environments, it's very easy to fire off an email. It's very easy to fire off a diary invite, to go back to the reference I had. Whereas once upon a time, if you had to go and talk to someone and say, oh, can you do 6:30? And I would say, oh, no, I can't actually. I've got bath and bedtime. It's a non-loaded thing. But just getting these generic emails coming through, it all, you're taking all this important mindful behaviour out of it.
Yeah. And that's something to think about even more, Clemmy, because I think, you know, during lockdown, when for most of us, our worlds just became completely virtual and, you know, you'd have teams working together. And it was fantastic that we were still able to connect virtually. It was also, you know, highly stressful for people because maybe they felt like, number one, you're always on show, you're always on screen, you know, all day, every day, which is exhausting and psychologically draining. But number two, people felt that they couldn't really express themselves, or some people were too expressive. Yeah. You know, there's, you know, we can read so much into meetings. There, I know of people, or people tell me that, you know, I run a team meeting and people never put their screens on, right? So what does that mean? And, you know, you can attribute different things to that, but, you know, and maybe the person who's got the screen off is thinking, I know I can't face it, or I don't feel able, or whatever. But it can be perceived as, you know, not being committed or not being interested. So there are lots of different ways in which the way that we work now can contribute to conflict. And I think as we go back to hybrid, a lot of places are going back to hybrid working, more face to face versus on screen. It's an interesting time to see what it's like. Seeing the adjustments and you know, I mean, I was in the office, well, I was in an office Thursday, Friday, Monday and Tuesday, and I was exhausted.
Were you,
from
the human interaction?
The commute, yeah. I was absolutely exhausted, and the commute as well.
But we did that. I just don't understand it. We did it for, you know, some people did it for their entire careers.
I know.
It's very odd, and I see it myself with, yeah, going back to social life and back to kids' parties, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, it's all that we want. I'm not saying that, but it's interesting. Do you think that we have changed, that we have adapted to, yeah, non-human interaction?
I think so. I think we have changed and adapted personally in my experience. And I remember I was actually delivering, it was a School of Life workshop, and there was a gentleman on the call. This was the beginning of lockdown, and he said, I think maybe we're talking about resilience or something. And he said, you know, I've spent my life, my 20-year career flying across the world, you know, working globally, at the sacrifice of building, of having a family and having friendships and connections, and I am full of regret that this way of living didn't exist previously, because I could have had more. So I believe that people who have suffered in different ways, or, you know, because of how we were before, I think now we're saying, well, actually, I'm not going to experience the conflicts that I used to experience. I'm not going to go in all the time, or forfeit dropping my child off to school to be in the meeting for 9 o'clock, or I'm not going to not attend the play at 5 o'clock. Instead, I will dial in and work from home. So I think there will be a shift I hope that there will be a shift in people's kind of willingness to be assertive and to focus more on their own individual needs. You know, I've seen, you know, when I had my daughters, I wasn't allowed to, you know, to if I worked from home, I wasn't allowed to have them at home with me. You know, I had to just put them in daycare. And yeah, on Zoom, I've seen women, you know, literally breastfeeding their child as they're learning, and as, you know, as they're on a workshop. And I think we've become more human in the, you know, in wanting to address our own needs, which means that we do have to be more prepared to engage in conflict and to say no, or to think about what works for us and what doesn't work for us. So for instance, I did 4 days in a row. I'm now thinking I'm not going to do four days in a row in the office again. I'm going to say that doesn't really work for me. You know, so I can do this and I can't do that. I hope so. I hope that people do pay more attention to their own
need.
You know, psychological and physical needs. Yeah,
but it's difficult because the conflicts, I imagine, are more than likely going to appear in digital spaces now. I can't see many people having face-to-face conversations about, you know, their working pattern or a tricky project at work, which is difficult because it's a very different skill. You know, look, we're talking and I do feel completely connected with you, but I also remember when I used to do my podcast in a studio, and there is something very, very specific about two people in a room, you know, the physical being of each other. And it's difficult. I don't know whether I'm lamenting something that will not come back in that way, or whether this is a positive step forward. Who knows, really?
Yeah, I think there is certainly more of a need for people to be able to have to express themselves about challenges virtually, because it is easy. I mean, you could do it over the water cooler, or you could do it, you know, it can be just relatively relaxed while you're having a coffee or whatever. So it can be a little bit of a kind of warmer intro into it. But now, if somebody has upset you, then you have to say, can we have a chat about this? Or you have to set up that meeting or call them on Teams. So it's very deliberate, and it can feel, or you have to be more courageous to begin that. And often people find that it's easier not to, which is why I'm really delighted in the work that I do, that what I teach is, I suppose, elements of self-awareness. How do you behave in a conflict situation? What are you likely to do? Giving them the skills and a framework. So what are the stages of having a difficult conversation? What are the different ways in which you can express yourself so that you walk away feeling that you've been able to, you know, to be authentic and to be honest without, you know, kind of overwhelming or doing it in a way that doesn't feel right for you? And there are lots of different ways of doing that.
Yeah, it's really interesting. We are in such a, because as you say, we've now seen inside one another's homes, we've seen the people's kids, but for some people, if depending on where you are at your career or how long you've worked where you work, you might never have met your colleagues in real life. So it's this in some ways we've been very intimate, but in other ways further away from one another. It's really fascinating.
Yeah. It's funny that you say that. I was working on a project during lockdown, and I hired a team, and so we'd been working together maybe for 6 months, and height came into it for some reason. And there was one woman who said, "Oh, you know, when you see me, actually, you know, you're going to realise I'm really tall. I'm like over 6 foot." I thought, "Oh, wow, I would never have known that." And then I had that the guy who was the head of service. He said, "Oh, I'm a real shorty. I'm a really small man." And I thought, "Oh, okay, that's interesting." So even kind of adjusting to how we are with each other physically, you're right, it's just something
else. And interesting, if those two people have been in a conflict environment in real life in an office, their physicality might impact it, but it's very different. So interesting. I'm looking at the time, being aware. I'm trying to think if there was one takeaway that, I mean, this is hard because this is like your whole expertise, but one takeaway for people listening in the realm of conflict, what would it be?
Well, I suppose one of the models that I teach this on the CEDAR course, is about managing emotions, because it's often about, you know, it's emotionally led, isn't it? And we teach something called the 3 R's for managing emotions. So when you are feeling emotional, or the other person is, first of all, stop to recognize what's happening. If there is a trigger, you will feel it. So make note of what's happening for you. You can't control that. Maybe you start to sweat, or your heart will start to be. So recognize what's happening for you, or recognize what's happening for the other person. Just take a moment. And then the second R is to reflect on that, or to respect it. So if something is happening for you, just take a moment to think, what's going on here? Or why is this happening for me? Or why is that happening for the other person? And acknowledge it. Often we might ignore it, but, you know, recognize it, reflect on it, and then choose and be deliberate to how you respond. So as you've said, and the responses can vary. It might be to respond in the moment. It might be, I need time for this. I need to take myself away. I need to, you know, reflect on it and come back tomorrow, most certainly. Or it might be, I need to be curious and understand, you know, what on earth is going on for this person? How can I try to understand what's happening for them? But be kind of slow down, I suppose. That's what it is. You feel something, you get triggered, or you see that you've triggered somebody else. Take a moment to kind of recognize what's happening in the moment. Reflect on, why might this be happening? What's the best guess? You may never know, but just give yourself that space, and then say, what do I do about this? What are the options available to me? As opposed to that knee-jerk reaction or not doing anything at all, which doesn't help anybody.
And it's actually, as you're talking, I'm thinking, the conflict that I hate that leaves you feeling wobbly is when everything is raw and emotional and not considered, and you feel exposed. Whereas, yeah, it's some real simple actions of, is this a good time for you? Or
is it a good
me
time?
Saying, you know what? I had a really bad night's sleep last night. I'm happy for talking about this, but I might not be my most rational.
Yeah. Or what on earth is happening for them? Because I really wasn't expecting this, right? I've just come here to do this and they've just kind of gone from 0 to 10. So what is happening for them? How can I be curious about what they're experiencing, which has led to this? So, which is not easy to do in the moment when they've really upset you, but just slowing things down so that you're more level-headed and you can participate more fully and, you know, in trying to move forwards through
it. And this is again anecdotal, but I really love it when someone says, I've been thinking about that conversation we had, not conflict or not conflict, and I've reflected this, and you know, whether that's changed or whether it's different. I love that when people do that, because yeah, the end is not the end often, and if it is still ticking over your head, saying, yeah, I've been reflecting about this, would you mind if I added this into it? I'm like, yes, I think that's such a grown-up way of going about things.
Yeah, that curiosity and being open-minded to want to know more, that's an invitation for active listening as well, isn't it? I want to understand what's happening for you, you know. And Stephen Covey in his book, one of his habits is seek first to understand and then to be understood, right? Because you know what's happening for you, but in the first instance, what's going on for you that I don't know about? Because once I can understand that, then, and I can kind of reflect that back to you, then you're more likely to want to hear what's happening for me.
It's really good. I really want to, my life goal now is to be more like you and be able to pull these. It's a really amazing skill to pull these references. I kind of remember them, but in some kind of blurry fashion. It's really impressive.
No, it's only the things that I really like. A lot of stuff just falls out of my brain like a sieve. But yeah, some stuff
I love it when you read something like, yes, they've articulated this thing that I've been trying to understand for myself. They've done it. So two more questions before I end.
Okay.
Where can people find you? And is there anything that you're working on that you want to shout about?
Where can people find me? That's an interesting one. I'm on LinkedIn. Great. I do have a website, which I'm a little bit ashamed about. It's just so basic. It's unbelievable. But I'm there, so my contact details are there. I work for the School of Life, so I deliver workshops for them, which I absolutely love. And I do a lot of work with CEDA, the Centre for Effective Dispute Resolution. So that's where a lot of my mediation practice comes in, where I kind of help people either before going to court or, you know, prior to litigation or instead of litigation, helping them to find a way forwards and resolve conflicts with other individuals or with organizations. So
it must be fascinating work. You're like getting when all your jewelry's tangled and then you finally get to fit people to, or does it sometimes go the opposite way to what you think? The things that look straightforward sometimes muddle themselves.
Well, it never looks straightforward, because when I receive the papers, people are always completely oppositional. Yeah. You know, one person says, you know, black, the other says white, one person says 250,000, the other says nothing. So they're always completely polarized. That is the starting point. The question is, what are they willing to do in order to move on from this so that they don't have to think about the conflict anymore? Because it's draining being embroiled in conflict. So what are they willing to do? And mediation, which is the process that I use, it requires flexibility, but it also requires the willingness to hear and understand the other person and to be open about what's happening for you. So it kind of pulls together all of the different things that we've spoken about today, and my role is just a neutral facilitator helping people to navigate through the conflict towards resolution.
Wow. Yeah, that's it. I mean, you're a very necessary role in trying to get people to strip the emotion out of stuff, which must be nearly impossible. And my last question, if you could have an honest conversation with one person, who would it be and what would you say?
Gosh, that's a really good question. How long do I have to think about this, Clemmy? I'm a reflector.
Yeah, sorry, you're not really, you don't want to...
If I could have an honest conversation with one person...
It can be dead or alive. It can be as fictional or non-fictional as you like. It can be... I'm not going to prompt you too much, otherwise I've given you the answer. You're a Libra, you want to weigh everything up.
I'm going to have... Yeah, of course I do. You know, I think I am generally a very... you know, this is my character. I'm a very forgiving person, you know, sadly. And, you know, I'm very empathetic. So I will always, as and being a Libra, I always look at both sides. So even if someone has hurt me or upset me, I'm always able to take the position of, well, what's happening for them, or what has led them. Not that I don't accept it and I'm not a punchbag, but I think I can let it go. I can forgive, because forgiveness is more about me rather than it is for them. So even people, you know, having an honest conversation, I almost don't, there are some conversations I haven't had to have because I know to let it go, or to believe I understand what they're going to say. Does this sound a bit arrogant? I think I know what they're going to say, and it's okay.
I have never clocked that, makes sense. That forgiveness is for yourself, not for the other person.
It's for me.
That's
for me.
Really powerful, though, isn't it? Because, yeah. So that is the most Libra answer. You've got no one you think you want to have an honest conversation with. This is why you're a mediator rather than someone who goes headfirst into conflict. It all makes sense. This is very revealing. Fair enough. So we've gone for a smiley face, as in just nothing. Perfect. That is a very powerful answer in itself. So we'll take it. Thank you so much. What a fascinating conversation.
Thanks, Clemming. Thank you. And thank you for your questions. Oh, thanks. Great question.
Yeah. I've got a lot of Libra. I'm not a Libra. I'm a Pisces, but I've got an awful lot of Libra in my chart. God, it's really fascinating. But also, I come from a family. I've got my dad and my brother are both lawyers. Or barristers. So I'm really interested in the idea of this kind of, and I guess therefore I'm from a household where there is a lot of going back and forth on ideas. But
yes,
it's definitely something that we all could do with working on more. I think actually the idea of managing conflict is a really fundamentally important thing, isn't it?
Yeah. It's interesting that you spoke about your family background, because my background was in I studied psychology. But I spent 14 years of my career working with lawyers. And so it was just, you know, it was very interesting because they're very different in their approach, right? The way they see things and where they get their energy from. And it was only when I had to spend a lot of time talking to them about the individual differences and kind of, you know, behavioral preferences and communication preferences that really helped, you know, could raise awareness of the difference, because there was a lot of conflict. But once you understand and once you're able to kind of step into it, it gets easier. But at first it was like, wow,
unreal.
You know, these people think in a
very... Unreal. Because they're unbelievably adept different. At what they do. But, this is extreme language, but there's a killer instinct if you're in that place, which is to find the way into something at all costs, really, because that's what they're paid to do. But it's...
It's fun as well. It's enjoyable, it's and it's energizing for you know people.
Yeah, no,
in
it's
that
amazing.
Way. Yes, and it's not energizing for others.
It's not energizing if you're a teenage daughter being told off, and it's just like whatever I'm going to say next. You've already know that I'm going to say it, and you've got an answer to it. So basically, it's the sooner I can work out that I'm wrong, the better. Funny, very funny.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that was fascinating. As I made very clear in the interview, I definitely want to be someone who can pluck all these quotes from everywhere. I think it's a great skill. It makes me want to be more academic, but that isn't relevant. What is relevant is unpicking conflict and knowing how important it is, but also being mindful about how we go into it. Taking time out, thinking about the other person, active listening. That is something I'm really going to try and do more of, because wading in with your own thoughts, or not even any thoughts, maybe just being preoccupied by your phone or what's for dinner, really is doing that person a disservice, and in turn doing ourselves a disservice, because we all want to be listened to. And yeah, learning to challenge people in a way that works for both of you feels like it could have huge positive impacts all round. So thank you so much, Tracy, for being a guest. And thank you guys for listening to me. As ever, I would always value your feedback. You can get in touch with me on butwhy@clemmytelford.com. or on Instagram or whatever platform you like. And please do join me next week. I am now off to go and find a birthday present for a 9-year-old. We are back full swing in kids' birthday parties, and I'd forgotten about this particular panic. I always thought that I'd be that kind of mum where you have a drawer of presents ready to go. I'm yet to achieve that, but maybe I've tapped onto two new goals today. More academic reading, more pre-purchasing of kids' presents. Watch this space. Have a good day and catch up with you next week. Bye.